Okay, admit it. If I say the words, "Feed me, Seymour," you know exactly what voice to do.
Oh yeah.
You're probably doing it right now.
It's impossible not to. It's just ingrained in our cultural DNA at this point.
Completely. We're talking about Little Shop of Horrors. And for most people, I think it brings up these very specific memories. You know, maybe watching Rick Moranis in the movie on VHS.
Right.
Or maybe seeing a high school production where the plant looked a little like a painted sleeping bag.
Right, right. It's generally remembered as this goofy, campy, singing plant comedy.
It is. It's colorful, it's loud, and it features a sadistic dentist. I mean, what's not to like?
Exactly. It feels like a Halloween romp.
But, and this is why I was so excited to dig into this stack of research you sent over. When you actually peel back the leaves, this isn't just a story about a florist. It's, well, it's kind of messed up.
Messed up is a gentle way of putting it.
It's a tragedy. It's basically a complex satire on the American dream, on capitalism, and the Faust legend, all wrapped up in doo-wop music.
And that is the mission for this deep dive. We are going to look at how a grainy, low-budget black comedy from 1960 somehow evolved into one of the highest grossing off-Broadway musicals in history.
And we have to talk about the puppets.
Oh, we have to talk about the puppets. The technical wizardry is just, yeah.
It's mind-blowing.
But more importantly, we need to explore why this story, which seems so silly on the surface, actually carries a fairly heavy social critique.
So set the scene for us, because before we get to the movie, everyone knows this started somewhere much grittier.
Right. To really understand Little Shop, you have to get the vibe. We are on Skid Row. It's the early 1960s. This is not the polished Technicolor world of classic Broadway.
No.
This is urban blight.
Yeah.
There's trash on the streets. The businesses are failing and the people are just desperate.
And yet the soundtrack to all this desperation is bouncy.
It is. It's doo-wop, early Motown, rock and roll.
Which feels like such a contradiction. I mean, why that specific sound for a horror story?
Well, that's the brilliance of the creative team, Howard Ashman and Alan Menken. And you might know them as the guys who saved Disney animation.
Right. The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast.
Aladdin. They basically defined the childhood of an entire generation.
Yeah.
But Little Shop was their breakout work before Disney, and it has this harder edge. Ashman chose that early 60s musical style very deliberately. I mean, think about 1960 in America.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of the last moment of innocence before the JFK assassination, before the Vietnam War really escalated, before the counterculture explosion.
So the music is kind of representing this naive optimism.
Exactly. The music is catchy, it's sunny, it's harmless, it disarms you, it lures you in, just like the plant lures in its victims.
Ah, okay.
If the music sounded like ominous horror movie strings, you'd be on guard. But because it's a girl group singing shoebop shbop, you don't realize how dark things are getting until it's way too late.
That makes so much sense. It's a trap.
It is. And speaking of the source material, they weren't writing this from scratch. They were adapting a 1960 film.
The Little Shop of Horrors, directed by Roger Corman, who is famous for shooting movies in, like, 2 days on a shoestring budget.
That is the one. And the original film was a black comedy, but it wasn't a musical. No songs. And there's a huge difference in the monster.
Yeah, I saw a picture of the 1960 plant. It looked kind of sad.
It was a crossbreed of a butterwort and a Venus flytrap. They called it Audrey Jr.
Jr. That does not scream world domination.
No, not at all. It was just this weird botanical accident. But for the musical, Ashman made a massive shift. The plant, now Audrey II, isn't a hybrid. It's an alien from outer space.
Which completely changes the stakes. It goes from man messes with nature to intergalactic invasion.
And to help narrate this invasion, Ashman added a Greek chorus.
The street urchins. Crystal, Ronette, and Chiffon.
Named after the famous girl groups of the era, the Crystals, the Ronettes.
Were chiffons.
Exactly. But they aren't just background. In a Greek tragedy, the chorus stands outside the action to comment on the moral decay of the heroes. And that's exactly what these girls do.
They're the only ones who really see what's happening.
Yeah, they're watching this whole tragedy unfold while snapping their fingers to the beat.
Okay, so let's get into the hero of our story. Seymour Krelborn. In my head, he's just this lovable nerd. But looking at the script, he's actually in a really, really bad spot.
Oh, he's tragic. He's a poor orphan living in a floral shop on Skid Row. He has nothing. No family, no money, no prospects.
And he works for Mr. Mushnick, who is not a great boss.
To put it mildly, he's verbally abusive. He's exploitative.
And then there's Audrey, Seymour's co-worker and the love of his life.
Audrey is just the heart of the show. She's so sweet, she has this very distinct fashion sense.
Lots of leopard print.
Always.
Yeah.
But she has zero self-esteem. She just doesn't think she deserves anything good.
Which leads her to date the villain of the piece, Orin Scrivello, DDS.
The dentist.
Right.
And this character is just designed to make the audience hate him instantly. He's sadistic, he loves inflicting pain, and he's physically abusive to Audrey.
So that creates this really intense pressure cooker for Seymour. He wants to save the shop, he wants to save Audrey, he wants to be someone.
And that is the moment the devil shows up. Or, you know, a plant.
The catalyst. A total eclipse of the sun. And suddenly, Seymour has this strange and interesting plant.
Which he names Audrey II. And at first, it seems like the answer to all his prayers. The plant is weird, so people come to see it. The shop starts making money. Seymour becomes a local celebrity.
But, like with any deal with the devil, there's a cost. The plant isn't interested in Miracle-Gro.
No. Seymour pricks his finger on a rose thorn, and the plant's pod just snaps open. It wants blood.
Now, this starts small, right? Like just a few drops from a finger.
Which is how the trap works. It's sustainable at first. Seymour thinks, I can handle this. It's just a little blood. And look at the rewards. Money, fame, respect. That's the song Grow For Me. It's the beginning of the compromise.
But the plant gets bigger, and the bigger it gets,
the more it needs, and then eventually it starts talking.
Feed me.
That's the pivot. The plant demands a body. And this is where the show gets morally so tricky. The plant suggests that if Seymour feeds it, he can get everything he wants, including Audrey. And it just so happens there's a guy standing in the way who nobody would miss.
The dentist.
Right. Seymour doesn't just decide to kill a random stranger. He targets the abuser. He convinces himself it's a righteous act.
But, and I think this is a detail a lot of people forget, Seymour doesn't actually murder him, does he?
This is such a critical distinction. Seymour goes to the dentist's office with a gun. He intends to do it.
Okay.
But he loses his nerve. He can't pull the trigger. However, Orin is using a nitrous oxide mask to get high. And the mask malfunctions, gets stuck.
Oh, wow.
Orin starts to asphyxiate. He's begging Seymour to help him.
And Seymour does nothing.
He just watches. He lets him die. In the eyes of the law, maybe it's not first-degree murder, but morally. He made a choice. He takes the body back and feeds it to the plant.
And once he crosses that line, there's no going back.
The floodgates just open. The plant grows massive. And this brings us to the visual spectacle. We have to talk about how they actually pulled this off on stage in 1982.
Yes. I was reading about the four stages of the puppet. It sounds exhausting for the performer.
It is an athletic feat. So stage one is the little potted plant, just a hand puppet. But stage two, this is the one in the song You Never Know.
I've seen clips of this. Seymour's holding the pot. You see both his legs. It looks like you see both his hands on the pot. But the plant is moving its mouth and neck independently. How is that possible?
It's this brilliant illusion. Seymour is wearing a prosthetic arm. The arm you see holding the side of the pot is fake. His real arm is tucked inside the pot, operating the plant's neck and mouth from within.
That is so clever. I had no idea.
But then it gets bigger. Stage three sits on the floor, and there's a puppeteer hiding inside the root system. But stage four is just a monster.
How big are we talking?
It dominates the entire stage. It can weigh hundreds of pounds. It has these branches that extend out, usually manipulated by stagehands. And inside the main pod, there's an actor who has to move the jaw.
I can't even imagine the conditions inside that thing.
It's brutal. It's hot. It's heavy. And you're doing a full cardio workout completely blind. And remember, the person inside isn't speaking.
Oh, right.
The voice of Audrey II is an actor off stage on a microphone. So the puppeteer has to lip sync or jaw sync perfectly to a voice they can only hear through monitors.
That requires incredible coordination. If you miss one beat, the entire illusion is ruined.
It does. And the physical growth of the puppet mirrors the thematic growth of the problem. It starts as something Seymour can hold in his hand, and it ends up as something that literally swallows the set.
Which leads us to the deeper meaning here. You mentioned this is a satire of capitalism. I think for a lot of listeners, that might feel like a stretch for a show about a singing flytrap.
It sounds academic, but it's actually right there in the text. I mean, think about what the plant represents.
It eats blood and gives money.
Right. It's basically commodity fetishism.
Okay, break that down for us.
It's the obsession with material goods, this belief that acquiring them will solve your problems or give your life meaning. Look at Audrey's big song, Somewhere That's Green. It's her I Want song.
Right? Like, I want adventure in the great wide somewhere, that kind of thing.
Exactly. But what does Audrey sing about? She sings about a tract house. She sings about plastic on the furniture, a chain link fence, frozen dinners, a garbage disposal.
A disposal in the sink. I remember that line.
It's a catalog of consumer products.
Yeah.
She doesn't have the language to describe emotional safety, so she describes the things that middle-class people own. She thinks if she just buys the right toaster, she'll finally be safe.
Wow, that is heartbreaking.
It is. And Seymour. He wants the girl, but he thinks he needs money and fame to get her. The plant offers the shortcut. It says, "I can give you the American dream. I can give you the toaster and the house. You just have to feed me people."
So the plan is basically unchecked greed.
Unchecked greed or capitalism without morality. It consumes everything. It consumes the enemies, like Orin, but then it consumes the innocent, like Mushnik. And finally, well, we have to talk about the ending.
The ending. Okay, this is the biggest divide between the casual fans and the hardcore theater nerds.
It's huge. If you grew up on the 1986 movie, you remember the happy ending. Seymour saves Audrey, he electrocutes the plant, the flower shop explodes, and they run off to their little house in the suburbs.
And a little baby plant smiles in the garden. Fade to black.
That is the Hollywood ending.
Yeah.
But the stage musical is a bloodbath.
It's so stark.
In the musical, Seymour tries to save Audrey from the plant, but he fails. She's mortally wounded. And as she's dying, she asks Seymour to feed her body to the plant.
Wait, she asks to be eaten? Why?
She wants to be part of the plant so that she can finally go somewhere that's green. Yeah, it's incredibly dark.
Right.
Seymour honors her wish and feeds her to the beast.
Oh, the heroine is dead.
And then Seymour, realizing he's lost everything, grabs a machete and runs into the jaws of the plant to try and kill it from the inside. And
And the plant eats him too.
everyone dies.
Everyone. The urchins are the only ones left. And in the finale, Don't Feed the Plants, the plant reveals its true plan. It wasn't just about Seymour. We find out that cuttings of the plant have been sold to florists all over America.
Like a franchise.
Exactly. The final image is the plants taking over the world. It's a full-on apocalypse.
Okay, yeah, I can see why movie audiences in the 80s might have rejected that.
They revolted. They actually filmed that dark ending for the 1986 movie. They spent something like $5 million on it, which was a huge budget then. They built miniatures of New York City. The plants were tearing down the Brooklyn Bridge, climbing the Statue of Liberty.
It was a Godzilla movie.
Totally. And test audiences hated it. They felt punished. They loved Seymour and Audrey, and watching them die just felt too cruel. So the studio forced the director, Frank Oz, to cut the whole thing and shoot a new happy ending.
Wow, that completely changes the message of the story. It neuters the satire. The stage musical says, if you make a deal with the devil for material success, it will consume you and everyone you love. The theatrical movie says, make the deal, then just zap the devil at the last minute and keep the girl.
Which is a much more comfortable lie.
Precisely.
But despite that grim ending on stage, the show was a massive hit.
Oh, huge. It ran for 5 years off Broadway. And what's interesting is that Howard Ashman refused to move it to Broadway.
Really? Why? Most creators would dream of that.
He knew the show worked because of the intimacy. He wanted the audience to feel trapped in the room with the plant. If you put it in a 2,000-seat theater, the puppet looks smaller. The threat feels distant.
But in a small off-Broadway house.
When that plant opens its mouth, you feel like you could fall in.
And clearly it worked. The show is a staple. High schoolers, community theaters.
It's the perfect show for schools. Small cast, one set.
Well, one set and a very, very large papier-mâché project.
True. But it gives students a chance to play really distinct characters. And the legacy of talent is incredible. Ellen Green is the icon, obviously.
Her voice is just unique. I don't know how else to describe it. It's so fragile and powerful at the same time.
But look at the people who have stepped into these roles recently. Jake Gyllenhaal, Jonathan Groff, Jeremy Jordan, Corbin Bleu. It attracts top-tier talent because the roles are so rich.
So, bringing this all back home, we have a show that lures us in with 60s nostalgia, makes us laugh with a puppet, and then brutally reminds us about the cost of greed.
That's the magic trick. It makes you laugh while it picks your pocket.
And the final warning of the show is literally the title of the last song, Don't Feed the Plants.
It's a catchy refrain. But if we apply the analysis we've been talking about, it's a genuine warning about, life.
Right, because in the real world, the plant isn't some vegetable from outer
Oh,
space.
well, the plant is the shortcut. It's the unethical choice that gets you the promotion. It's the little lie that saves you money. It's that moment you decide to step over someone else to get what you want.
It starts with just a drop of blood.
And it seems so easy. Just this once, just a little bit. But the nature of that beast is that it always, always grows.
That is a chilling thought. We all have a little Audrey the Second sitting on our desk somewhere, whispering promises.
And the question is, do you have the strength to starve it?
Well, on that cheerful note, I think I'm going to go water my succulents and keep a very close eye on them.
Probably a safe bet.
Thanks for listening to this deep dive into the flora and fauna of Skid Row. We'll catch you next time. And seriously, don't feed the plants.